Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the forthcoming elections in Ivory Coast and the impact of foreign influence. Our guest today is Dr. Jesslyn Lemke. Dr. Jesslyn Lemke is an independent media researcher. She's a journalist and former assistant professor of journalism at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. She specializes in journalism and international communication, and she is undertaking multiple reporting trips to Francophone Africa, including Ivory Coast, where she's done a lot of outstanding research. Jesslyn, I'm very, very happy to have you join me today, and I look forward to an exciting conversation.
Thank you, Michael. It's so wonderful to be here. Hello from the West Coast of the United States.
Yeah, I'm sorry for waking you up from the bed. Alain, it's 7 a.m. in where you are over there. Okay, let's start off with this. So in October this year, Ivory Coast is going to have an election that is very pivotal in terms of the current president, Alassane Ouattara, is 82 years old. So he will be seeking for his fourth term if he decides to run. And we've had a little bit of controversy as well in terms of some candidates that have been disqualified. And just talk about the political landscape and election landscape. And also knowing that the election history in Ivory Coast, in this small Francophone country, has always been one that is that tends towards violence and has that history of electoral violence. How can you describe this political landscape and all of these different issues surrounding candidacy?
Sure. Well, thank you for letting me on your podcast today. The situation right now in Abidjan is pretty complex, and it's very tense right now. So essentially what's happened is that Alassane Ouattara has already been president since 2010. So he has already been in power for 15 years. And in that time, in 2016, he amended the constitution to give himself a third term. So in 2020, he gave himself a third term. So he is already serving this extremely questionable third term. And over the last series of 1 to 2 years, through this kind of magical combination of legislative and judiciary technicalities, his administration has managed to snuff out all of the four serious contenders for the presidency in 2025. And that includes Thiam, who is a prominent businessman. He was very popular among the people. He was the running candidate, I believe, for the PDCE. And he was ruled out earlier this year. And so now the only strong candidate on the ballot is Ouattara. And June Afrique just came out with a story saying that there are 33 small-time candidates who have put their names on the ballot. But it's everyone from, like, you know, village pastors to a former beauty queen. And so Ouattara has set the stage to just kind of claim the the presidency for a fourth term. And so people on the ground are, you know, I have friends in Abidjan who are calling him a dictator. And people are upset, obviously. They're 15 years into a presidency, and the situation is not looking good. People are waiting to spend money until after the election. People are not taking out huge loans. They're not buying cars. They're not constructing homes. Everything is kind of on pause this summer as people wait to see if violence or conflict is going to break out. Now, as you briefly mentioned, in 2010 and 2011, Ivory Coast had a presidential election that really went sideways, where Laurent Gbagbo had already been president. He was the sitting president, and he refused to leave his presidency when Ouattara had essentially won the vote, and it devolved the country into this 3-month civil war where many people died. 3,000 people died in 2011. And so that is the backdrop to and the lead up to this election. You know, has Ouattara provided the country with some economic stability? Yes. Has he brought in some helpful infrastructure over the last 15 years to some of the rural areas? Yes. But it's also, he's dealing with a tinderbox right now.
Very, very interesting you mentioned that. And I think the kind of conversation we had before we started this, I think I might have this once this concluded and see if you can be a part of that project. Now I'm thinking about it. So before I get into the election bit, what we've seen a trade-off. So you mentioned what Ouattara has done in terms of the economy, in terms of infrastructure, which are very laudable. But then again, what is done also is there seems to be a trade-off between that and authoritarianism in terms of extending the constitution, amending the constitution, you know, and entrenching one's power over there. And we see similar stuff in Uganda with Museveni back in this, when the West with IMF and World Bank, you know, as long as Museveni is kind of those reforms, you know, they don't care what he's doing with in terms of human rights of the people and all of that. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen in Gabon as well. We've seen in Rwanda, we've seen where these elections that looks like a sham election, where people are winning over 90% or whatever. In Rwanda, Paul Kagame won over 90% of the votes. And it looks like, is this a sham? And so what I guess the question is, should we trade that kind of economic gain of friendship? But we see in the Park Academy, people argue and say, well, it's an authoritarian democracy, but we're seeing economic movement in there. Should we trade that for democratic principles or fair people being able to fairly contest, people being able to have freedom of speech and all of that? Do you think that is a necessary trade-off in African context?
Yeah, that's a very moral question. I think that you know, what you're saying is, should we trade economic stability for like a total loss of civil freedom or human rights or democracy? And I think that it's important to reflect on the type of government that the Ivory Coast is, or the type of government that you tend to see in West Africa. So there's a scholar, Marie Soleil Frere, who said that she kind of outlined the type of government in countries in West Africa as being semi-authoritarian, where the presidential administrations will hold these elections, they'll hold you know, speaking posts, they'll give the illusion that you are in a democracy, but behind the scenes, everything is essentially more of an elite trending toward authoritarianism, where you have many presidents, you know, fixing the books so that they can have another presidency, or snuffing out candidates, or journalists being jailed, or, you know, human rights issues, human rights grievances. And so this idea of a democracy in West Africa, she argues that, you know, these are new, kind of new democracies that have only seen been set up since the 60s or the 70s, and they're still developing what their stage is going to look like. So, you know, I don't, as for, you know, I'm not a citizen of Ivory Coast, so I don't benefit from the fruit of, am I in a democracy or am mm-hmm. I in a stable economic dictatorship? But I think that certainly from the other coups that we have seen in the past 4 years, we have seen coups in neighboring nations of Burkina mm-hmm. Faso, Mali, and Niger. The junta in each of those countries performed a coup d'etat because they were dissatisfied with the government. And that was important to them. And they were very mm-hmm. popular among the people. Mm-hmm. So I think that speaks for it for those countries, that people do want, you know, a fair shake when it comes to human rights and fair elections and so forth.
Mm. I agree with you. One of my presentation in the conference I was mentioning, because that was just based on the current project that I'm working on, was rethinking the adoption of liberal democracy and the act of selecting or electing leaders in Africa. And then you will see that if you look at the survey by Afrobarometer, the majority of African citizens.
The what barometer?
The Afrobarometer. Okay. You know, Afrobarometer survey. Yeah. So the survey, the majority of African want democracy. Yeah. Even among the countries where the juntas are popular, they want democracy. They prefer democracy, yeah. And that is good news on one end. But people are also beginning to warm up to military coups and warming up to military coups as another legitimize military coup as an entry point into power. So, which is, to me, I think is dangerous. But if we look at Ivory Coast, for instance, we'll come back to all of this. But for instance, let's go to the candidate. So we look at how in the power struggle, let me use your word, snuff out, you know, credible position. Let me borrow that word. Yeah. So we've snuffed out, disqualified Thiam, who seems to be the most credible, the most among the candidates that presented, you know, more of a threat to Ouattara. But we've also seen former President Laurent Gbagbo being disqualified as well, and several of all of these people. How do you see, because Thiam has also vowed to continue to fight.
Okay.
So yeah. Do you think there's going to be a repeat of the Gbagbo episode that we had in 2011?
So that's, I was talking with, I have a good friend who lives in Abidjan, and kind of anything is possible right now. Mm-hmm. If you as a 15-year president,
that's long.
Eliminate everybody who could have stood against you, and then that person says, "Well, I'm going to continue to try to have this presidency." That sets the stage for conflict. It obviously sets the stage for conflict. Obviously, people are not playing by the rules, and they're dealing, like I said, they're kind of dealing with a tinderbox. Do I think that there's going to be some type of disturbance? Like I said, my friend last night, when I was discussing with him, said that everyone is really on edge right now in Abidjan. People are really, really afraid that Ouattara is going to put himself on the ballot or go through with already being on the ballot. Mm. And so it's causing a lot of fear in people right now, because most people who are living in Abidjan right now lived through the 2010 civil war, and they all remember that, how awful that was.
Yeah, it was really awful. We it was in May. There was this scare of a coup.
Yeah,
would have come to the bunk. How do you think that was? Was that just disinformation? Or was that just a smokescreen, or what do you think? Do you think
it was a fake coup, and it was quite convincing, and it really did. It went viral, and people were shooting it up. But then everyone in Abidjan, when they were getting phone calls from friends, They're like, actually, I just woke up, but it was another normal day. Nobody, nothing has happened. Hmm. But I think, you know, we'll probably get to this later in the episode, but I think that particularly because things are so tense on the ground right now, that disinformation on social media and the ability for exterior actors to manipulate the social media public sphere right now is very, very at risk. So I think people being cautious about what they're consuming online about Ivory Coast politics, particularly when it comes to posts on Facebook or Twitter, that, you know, those platforms are incredibly easy to manipulate. And, you know, if a page has 2 million people and you write some fake news, you've just misinformed 2 million people. So that is actually where my research comes in, is studying the connection between disinformation and on the ground violence in Ivory Coast.
We've interesting you mentioned that, and I'll speak on the disinformation a bit. We did recently did, or not recently, 2 years ago, we did stuff for the EU. I was involved in it, looking at disinformation in four continents or four countries. I handled the Nigerian case, and they look at Iraq. We look at some countries in Europe as well. And surprisingly, more disinformation didn't come from the terrorist organizations that were studying. It was coming from the government side, relating to elections, relating to stuff like that. But if we come to Ivory Coast, so we've seen in the Sahel, we've seen Russian misinformation. And we've also seen the anti-French sentiment that swept through the Sahel and swept through former French colonies. But for some reason, it seems Ivory Coast has been shielded from that anti-French sentiment that has swept through Chad, Burkina Faso, and Gabon. Why is that so? Do you think that is on the threat from Russian disinformation?
Oh, so there's two questions unpacked there. You've said, you know, there's this anti-French sentiment that seems to be sweeping through West Africa. Is Cote d'Ivoire part of that trend? But then, you know, you also pointed out, is Ivory Coast vulnerable to misinformation from Russia right now? And so to answer your first question, anti-French sentiment is alive and well in Ivory Coast. It is alive and well in Ivory Coast. So, you know, Ouattara has always aligned himself with France and with Paris, and he enjoys a close relationship with the president of France, Emmanuel Macron. But just because Ivory Coast has not joined the alliance, the AES, which is the new Sahelian alliance that left ECOWAS, the regional body that connects a lot of the countries of West Africa, just because they have not joined does not mean that the population loves France. So I can again refer back to the 2010 civil war where France essentially helped install Ouattara into power. They have at many moments in Ivory Coast history been incredibly hated, particularly for just to back up, France owns more than 500 corporations in Ivory Coast. They have had a strong military presence there for almost 60 years. They had a military base there. They have active soldiers in Ivory Coast. And in January, the French government pulled out of the 43rd Bima. I know the word in French, but in English, it's the 43rd Bima, which is their famous military base in Cote d'Ivoire. And they pulled their military soldiers, saying that we're no longer needed here. But that was just performative. And they've commentators say that France is obviously still here. They still have a military presence here. And so I would say that the majority of Ivoirians that I have ever spoken with are very upset about this dynamic of France-Afrique operating in Ivory Coast. And France has a lot of, what you really need to remember is that France has a ton of economic investments in the economy of Ivory Coast. And when the economy of Ivory Coast is going well, they like that because their businesses there earn stock and they earn, you know, percents and dividends. The stock market benefits these French corporations. Okay. And so, there's a strong current of anti-French sentiment in Ivory Coast because they're kind of have suffered from French post-colonial rule for a long time. And then and I think also that is tying into some of the anti-Ouattara sentiment that we're seeing on the ground because he has aligned himself with France. Now your second question, is Ivory Coast vulnerable to misinformation from Russia right now? There was this big report that came out last year from the Africa Center for Strategic for Strategy, I think, and by the U.S. Department of Defense. And it had this, it was this staggering report that said that there have been 189 disinformation campaigns in Africa in the last 5 years, and 60% of those were from foreign governments. And of that 60%, a huge portion were Russian misinformation campaigns. And they were all targeting African nations who have a history of conflict, and they were targeting them during periods of elections. So, you know, obviously Ivory Coast is well within the crosshairs of those criteria. And the fact that the Wagner Group or Russia has already had a hand in potentially even the presidency for Burkina Faso for Ibrahim Traore. They wanted him as a candidate. And so, you know, I don't have physical proof or physical evidence that, that they are targeting people, but it would certainly not be out of the question.
Very, very interesting. Let me unpack the first one. So in the conference, there's a guy that talked about the France-Afrique and the continued persistent influence of France in these places. But we have another guest that came through, and it's this like colleague as well as a friend that tried to kind of like undermine French interests, economic interests in these places. But it's good that you mentioned that. Now, what we've seen is good. Again, you rightly said that the French, under the guise of multilateralism, because the UN operation assisted in ousting Babou at the time, so it looked like. But it was, we know it's a French stuff now, and installed Ouattara. Now, what we've seen over the years since independence in Ivory Coast, with the kind of agreement the first president, President Félix, made with the French, and then having those military bases that you mentioned, the military bases, French soldiers and all of that. And what we've seen, again, is like the military looks to have been weakened in Ivory Coast. The military seems to and that seems to be like the general kind of thing among these countries. We've seen it in Cameroon as well, where Paul Biya, that's another, we had a recent episode on that as well, where within his 92, he's going to come for election, where what has happened is like the weakened the core military, but then they have people that protect the regime that they kind of like. So, but in the case of France has been like more like regime protection. But do you think, again, that they've done, how strong is the Ivory Coast military? Because it does look that it doesn't present a threat when it comes to coup or whatever. How strong it is, the French military?
So you're saying how strong is Ivory Coast military? Could they go through a coup and survive it?
Yeah, could they? Yeah, could they threaten?
So that's a great question. And this is outside my wheelhouse. I don't know how strong the Ivory Coast military is. What I can say is that you do have the state government, the state police, and the state military organizations, right, that are aligned with obviously the presidency of Ouattara, right? But for example, in 2010, Gbagbo also had the state government, or excuse me, the state military at his disposal. And they were loyal to him. And Ouattara had actually for quite some time, actually had quite a few military forces who were loyal to him. And he had his own rebel soldiers who were loyal to Ouattara in 2010. And so I think that question is multifaceted, because what it really is more important is who else has the guns, right? Does Thiam have any kind of military support or rebel faction or rebel militia who would support a coup? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But like I said, that's a little bit outside my wheelhouse.
That's interesting. So how about let's look at all the, you mentioned the U.S., the U.S. defense and the report that came out. What is the interest of all the Western nations outside of France and Russia? Does the U.S., for instance, we've seen Trump's Africa policy. But we've also seen where he's trying to ban a lot of African countries. But on the same hand, we've seen him invited a couple of African leaders recently to the White House, from Senegal, Liberia, I think, and three other countries. Mm-hmm. So do you think this kind of like mixed of, what is the U.S., for instance, does the U.S. have interest in Ivory Coast? Do they have, or any other country, for instance, would you know if they have any interest in the outcome of these elections?
Yeah, so typically I just did this research on the anti-French sentiment, the anti-French coups that swept through West Africa. And in the process of reading a lot of literature about that, I discovered that primarily what the United States devotes money to in West Africa is anti-terrorism efforts. So they devote a lot of intelligence to tracking the terrorist activity at the northern border of Ivory Coast and Burkina Faso, because there was some violent extremism activity up there in the last 4 or 5 years. But that seems to, you know, and then like USAID in 2020 did this enormous political initiative to try to stabilize the elections in 2020 but if you read the results of that $11 million effort by USAID in Ivory Coast, a lot of it was geared toward calming terrorism, identifying terrorism, having the radio broadcasts about peace or peaceful elections going out into areas that were prone to conflict in the rural north of Ivory Coast. So I would say that the United States, typically its interest is in just deflecting terrorism and keeping up with intelligence on terrorism.
Okay, very interesting. So let's see the candidates there. So very interesting. Now I saw Babu's wife on the list of the candidates that were well qualified. Do you have any commentary on that?
Say that one more time.
I mean, Babu's wife was on the. I don't know if you're aware that she's on the list.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Well, was she? I can't remember now. Was she? Is she off the ballot? Or is she?
Still no. She's still on the ballot. That's what. As far as I know, I don't know if she's still. Yeah. But she's still on the ballot.
Well, Simone Gbagbo has a very interesting story. She was very active in politics with Laurent Gbagbo, even in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. She's always been politically active. And she, in 2010, when the UN and the French and Ouattara's military stormed Gbagbo's palace, she was with Laurent Gbagbo that day in April of 2011. She was with him when he was arrested. So all the news photos of the soldiers breaking into the palace, those photos include her. So she has a long history of being in the nation's politics. She formed her own country, or excuse me, she formed her own
party.
She formed her own country. She formed her own party, and I don't know the name of the party, but that's wonderful. I mean, good for her. I think that I'm sure that she has a lot of you know, representation for women. I'm sure that that is going to, that that's a selling point for her. But other than that, I don't know too much more about her running for the presidency. But she certainly has had a lot of publicity in the country.
But another thing we've been seeing now, I don't know if this is good, but we've also seen it in America where Trump came back. We've been seeing these former leaders coming back into power. So we saw it in South Africa with Jacob Zuma trying to come back. We saw it in Malawi with we saw it recently in Ghana. John Mahama successfully came back and regained, you know, gained back power. John Mahama. We've seen it in we're seeing it where Lauren Gbagbo is trying to come back. And then again, you look at that, you just oppose that with the continent's young population. And then you ask and say, why are we getting these 80-year-olds or old people who come back to power where the population is a youthful population? What is how? And then you're seeing in Kenya, for instance, you're seeing, you know, this youth protest. You're seeing in Zimbabwe and in Mozambique where the youth are protesting the election in those places. So, but I don't know about the youth in Ivory Coast. And are they, how active are the youth when it comes to things like this? Do you think there could be a case where there could be a youth revolution or youth protest against, or are they ones that we naturally just go with the flow or just not interested, disinterested in politics? I don't know.
Sure. You know, the youth in Ivory Coast have traditionally always had a political party that tries to represent the youth. So I could really get this wrong, but I want to say that Blaise Goudé was very popular among the youth for a long time in Ivory Coast. Thiam, who was just you know, sidelined in the election, he is younger, and he had a lot of popular vote among the youth in Ivory Coast. The majority of the country actually is under the age of 35 right now. So voters are the youth. Additionally, the people most likely to be active on social media right now are probably the youth, right? People who are technically literate, so they know how to use a phone and hit like and write things out in French and spell. So I think that the youth have been very active in this in the last few years. I don't know what is fomenting behind the scenes among the youth right now, or what candidate the youth support. Additionally, I have heard in speaking with university students in Ivory Coast, I learned something interesting a number of years back, which is that while students are in college, they are sometimes approached by political parties who will pay a portion of their tuition if they agree to support them politically and like come out as a supporter of that political party once they graduate. And they don't even necessarily have to become a soldier. They just have to like support the party. And so even while they're in college, people are being solicited to join or support a political party in Ivory Coast. I thought that was very interesting.
I don't think that's even peculiar to Ivory Coast. It's the story of many of these places where they get any youth with some level of influence or some level of followership, or, you know, to just so that I've been approached to launder the image of these politicians and just write something positive about them and make them. But let's start to wind them and look at them and say, what do you see moving forward? So do you see in terms of this is going to be different layers now. So in terms of the constitution that I've been definitely, you see that is that constitution have been kind of amended many times to accommodate Ouattara. Like I said, it's not only, but we've seen this in all of these countries where they amend the constitution to prolong their stay. So in terms of that, and also in terms of the disqualifications of and also the general political climate against the background of disinformation, against the background of the neighbors happened in the neighboring stuff. And you mentioned terrorism as well. one thing I didn't say is that the United States and other Western countries are afraid that there's going to be a spillover effect of insurgent groups in the Sahel moving to the coast. And we've seen it happening. There's been a lot of interest in the coastal regions, in Togo, Benin, Ivory Coast. You know, there'd be a lot of studies, a lot of attention focused to that. So, you know, on against all of this background and backdrop, what do you see, or how do you see everything playing out? If Ouattara runs, if it doesn't run, and all of this climate, what do you project? With your experience of that, sure, with our country moving forward?
I think that my friends in Abidjan are right to be a little nervous right now. They have already had several disturbances in the past few months with the coup, or with, you know, on June 20th, Thiam was ruled off of the, his candidacy was ruled out, and that also caused some protests. I think that given Ivory Coast's history, right, so they had, well, they had a decade-long civil war, and then they had the additional civil war in 2010 and 2011. Additionally, in 2020, when Ouattara voted himself in for a third term, there was actually quite a bit of election violence around that. And, you know, several people died during those protests. And that was only 5 years ago. So, in speaking with friends on the ground, everyone is extremely nervous that he will vote himself in for a fourth term and put himself in for another 5 years. And so I think that given that, and given the Russian, or excuse me, not Russian, but given the rise of disinformation happening right now online, I think that the things are very volatile, and I think anything could happen at this moment. I certainly think that there is going to be some type of political protest. If not a coup, then some type of political protest, because the people there, the other thing is the people there know how to do that. They've protested before. Unemployment is running quite high. People cannot afford the things that they need, right? Gas or food. People are on edge. And all of those form a very, very compelling recipe for a coup.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, it doesn't seem like it's there's a positive. It seems like it's bleak. But again, we can only remain hopeful, and be optimistic that everything turns out right. Well, like I said, it's sad, and elections, and the case of Ivory Coast is just not very peculiar. It sounds like the typical case of many African states. But anyway, it's been an amazing time with you, Jesslyn. I really appreciate your insights and you taking our time early in the morning in Oregon to join us. We're forever grateful to that.
Thank you for having me on. It's been really interesting to discuss this. Absolutely.
Okay, so yeah, that's, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you too, Doctor.
Thank you for joining us today, and as usual, join me to thank our guest, who has had an early start today, Dr. Jesslyn Lemke, for her very insightful commentary on the forthcoming elections in Ivory Coast. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.